Okay, good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to be the moderator for this imaging symposium. The title is Current and Future Research Trend in Nuclear Medicine. My name is Osama Malawi, and I am with MD Anderson Cancer Center. Today we have three speakers that will talk about the different aspects of current and future trends in nuclear medicine. We have Dr. Tim Turkington, who will give us a talk about the instrumentation in nuclear medicine and its future trends. Then we have Dr. Mike King, who will be talking about quantification in nuclear medicine. And finally, we have Dr. George Seguros, who will be talking about... George, your talk... dosimetry in nuclear medicine. Dr. Tim Turkington is from Duke University. Dr. Mike King is from UMass Medical. And Dr. Seguros is from Johns Hopkins. And we'll start with Tim Turkington. Thank you. Please make sure that you silence all your cell phones. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For those of you who just came in, there's still a couple seats down in the front. I want to list these disclosures. And I also would like to understand who the audience is a little bit better. Those of you who are directly involved in nuclear medicine work, raise your hand. Okay. Those of you who do other imaging mostly, raise your hand. And those of you who do radiation therapy, and those who just came in to get out of the heat outside. Okay. Okay. So if you haven't flown on U.S. Airways in July of this month, I recommend it just because there's a nice article on the city of Philadelphia in there, in their magazine. And the you know, it makes sense for them to have an article on Philadelphia because that's one of their main hubs and makes it more attractive to you to have a layover there in Philadelphia, or just at least to change flights, because you know what a great city you're spending a half hour in. But there was a great quote in there. Philadelphia has just blossomed in terms of arts and culture. People love the location between New York and Boston. And it may very well be the last major affordable city in the Northeast. This is from the president of a prestigious Philadelphia university. I won't tell you which one, because that would identify the person. This is one of those quotes that they blew up really big, in big letters. So in giving this overview talk, I'm going to try to strive for fairness, completeness, insight, wisdom, accuracy, and or precision, whichever is the appropriate one. And to make another noun, interestingness, and I think we'll all agree at the end that I won't accomplish any of those. I'm talking about nuclear medicine, specifically instrumentation. When I started working in nuclear medicine, doing SPECT research with Ron Jazak, my mentor, he pointed out that you can make a lot more improvement in what you can measure and what you can image by making a new radio tracer than you can by making improvements to the instrumentation. That's just a fundamental truth. I think there are very few exceptions to that. And here's prostate cancer with FDG. It's not very good. Here's prostate cancer with a good tracer, with fluorocholine. And, there is some uptake there in the prostate, but the contrast isn't very good, and you can improve the instrumentation tenfold, and it still won't make the improvement that is. But we're not going to be talking about this today. We are going to be talking about trying to squeeze better performance. So who needs new technology? My son was perfectly happy on this old tractor, but when it comes to, say, a PET scan, you want the best image quality you can get. You want the latest technology, like this. Well, actually, the point here is that this image was produced on a PET scanner that arrived in our institution in 1992, and I bet none of you would have guessed that. This system was being designed in 1989 and 1990. And the point is, there have been advances in what you can do with PET systems over these last 18 years, but they haven't been radical. They haven't made images that are just obviously lots better, regardless of what you might be told by the manufacturers. There have been incremental improvements. Adding CT to PET means that you could produce this much faster, and this actually was done using an iterative algorithm that did not exist on the scanner when it came. But for the most part, we have to keep in mind, you know, what are the small incremental changes and what are the improvements that you get from those incremental changes after many years, and what are the dramatic changes. So here's the state of things sort of on the PET end. First of all, you don't buy a PET system anymore. As we all know, it's all PET CT systems. Here's Hitachi inside. It's actually sort of a different PET rotating partial ring. This is the GE system. This is a now Siemens system that comes with actual windows, which is nice. And here's the Philips system with separate PET and CT. By analogy to camels, these are the dromedary single-humped PET CTs, and this is the Bactrian two-humped device. So regarding this current PET CT instrumentation, first of all, as I said, all new PET development is being done on PET CT. Well, there's some exceptions to that. New CT components are available in PET CT very quickly after they're available as standalone CT. For example, when 16-slice CT became available, 16-slice as a part of PET CT was available very soon after that. And that what that means is the integration is very loose. They don't change the CT a lot to incorporate it in with the PET, and that seems to be an ongoing thing. Each manufacturer offers an array of combinations of PET and CT components, but generally not all possible combinations, every PET with every CT. And except for Philips, these systems are built on blocks of detectors, these blocks which include an array of crystals and four or one multi-cathode photomultiplier. Here are two from Siemens, and here are two from GE. These two are the actual same total dimensions and just divided into smaller crystals, and that's the same with this, and these things are put together in modules and into rings of detectors. And in the end, one of the major goals in PET design is to improve the statistical quality of the images that you produce. And the statistical quality of the raw data is spelled out here. When you look at all the counts that you get, and they're referred to as prompt events. They're true events, scattered events, random events. These are the two kinds of background that you get. You want to build your image out of true events, so you take your prompt events, and then you subtract off estimates of scatter and randoms, and those corrections are very accurate these days. Randoms corrections are very accurate. Scatter corrections have become very accurate. And the issue is this estimate of true events that comes from this correction is accurate, but it's not as precise. There's more variability in this than there would be if you had true events that had been obtained without any background. That's a statistical issue, because the variance in T is equal to the sum of the variances of these parts here. They don't subtract, they add. The variances always add. And when you do this processing, you come up with something that would be equivalent to the counts that you would get without any background. That's called this noise equivalent count parameter. And it's the square of the signal to noise, sort of. And it's this. It's the true counts divided by 1 plus the ratio of scattered events to trues plus the ratio of random events to trues with maybe a factor of 2 depending on how the random events are processed. So what this says is more true events is good, but keeping the scatter down and keeping the randoms down is also good. If you increase the true events that you collect but do that in a mode that also increases the scatter or random events, you may or may not have improved image quality. So getting this thing as high as possible and also getting the spatial resolution, sort of the accuracy at which you're measuring each event as high as possible, is a good way to look at improving PET images. If you get more counts, this is just a phantom scanned 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 2.5, and so on. Each scan was half the duration of the previous one, and you can see, as expected, that the image quality degrades with each factor of 2 in counts, but the image quality does not degrade as quickly as you might guess. A factor of 2 in counts does not make really dramatically improved images. It takes a lot of more counts to make images that we would all say are obviously better. And so that's one of the points. Why does that this image from 1992 instrumentation look about almost as good as what we can get today? Well, you'd have to have a lot more counts to get a lot better image. So the state of the art, what we currently have with PET, we have these multi-ring systems. You get better sensitivity for a whole body study if you have more rings looking at that body. And if you do that in 3D mode, where you don't have these septa and you can see photons coming out in all trajectories, that gives you the highest sensitivity to true events at the expense of getting some more scattered and random events. Now, on the other side of nuclear medicine, single photon imaging done with gamma cameras is even a more mature technology. It's built on this gamma camera concept, the Anger camera, which is designed about 50 years ago, with this very elegant analog electronics, sodium iodide crystal, array of photomultipliers, readout to give both the energy and the position of the photon coming out. And so here are some typical a fixed 90-degree camera for cardiac imaging, 2 heads, either at 100, that can be positioned at 180 degrees or 90 degrees, and then something that's not as common these days, which is a 3-head system. And that third head gives you 50% more counts, and so it's, why don't we have more of these? Those more counts should help. But it's interesting that those have sort of gone by the wayside. Now, a lot of the improvement that's come in nuclear medicine imaging has come from iterative image reconstruction. It provides, I think, at least 3 sort of independent good benefits. First of all, it's the different and mostly better noise quality compared to filtered back projection, which was the conventional way of doing things. It gives you the capability to correct for physical effects directly in the reconstruction. And it gives you the capability to reconstruct data not complete enough for filtered back projection. And here's just a situation looking at the noise properties, filtered back projection with some particular apodizing filter, and say 2 iterations of overordered subsets, EM. And is there any possibility of turning the lights down a little bit more? Because it's just part of the screen, especially the front lights there that are right on the screen. But most people would look at this and say it's a better image. Now, of course, when we talk about image quality, the question always has to be, we're asking about image quality for some particular task. So if someone says, is this image better than that one, you say, well, for what task? And for ruling out lesions that have, metastases that have spread to outside the body, this one is much better because you can see there's nothing outside the body. But that's an irrelevant task, right? But anyway, overall improvement, I think most people would agree, in most situations, this image is better than that image. Now, what's going on in image acquisition, data acquisition, and image reconstruction? I think it's very helpful to think about this process in this way. You have radioactivity in this body area, and you can divide that up into regions, just like you do in the final image, call them pixels or voxels or whatever. And this formula is just expressing that for any voxel in here with activity in it, the process, the imaging process, is saying, what's the activity in this voxel? Multiply that by the probability that activity in that voxel will be detected along any given detector element, and sum that up for all voxels and all the probabilities for all voxels and all detection bins. So this is just a matrix operation here. And then add in any background that you might have measured, and that tells you how many counts you'd get along this line. The counts you get along this line is just the sum of all the activity along that line times the probabilities that, the activity will go in that direction. So image reconstruction would be accomplished by taking all these measurements and going the other way and calculating the estimates of this. To do that, all you need to do is invert that matrix, P. Well, that P is a huge matrix, and filtered back projection is one way of sort of inverting that matrix. It's one way of getting those matrix elements. Now, the maximum likelihood EM algorithm, which came out over 20 years ago, 25 years ago, is another way, an iterative reconstruction algorithm for estimating what the activity was in each of these pixels based on these measurements. And this is what it looks like. I'm not going to talk too much about it, but a big part of what's going on is you have your current estimate, you have your image estimate. From that image, you can estimate, if this were the correct image, how much activity would we have measured along this line? And you take the ratio, what you actually measured along that line, with what you think you measured based on the current update of the image. Then, based on any discrepancy, you make a new image. So that's this iterative process. And it gives you images that go from very, very smooth to very, very noisy. And in 50 or 100 iterations. And an iteration of MLEM takes longer than a filtered back projection reconstruction. So even now, iterative MLEM would be impractical clinically. One good goal for the reconstruction algorithm is that it has to be at least as fast as the acquisition process, or else you'll have a backlog. So if you're doing PET scans, say 3 minutes per bed position, if the reconstruction takes longer than 3 minutes, then you're going to get a backlog. So OSEM, the algorithm that came from Hudson and Larkin in the early 1990s, was a way to improve that just by updating the image on fractions of the whole data and then going through different fractions of the whole data and updating the image. And that's made iterative reconstruction feasible. Now, to do full image reconstruction with all the physical processes, you just have to consider, what is this P? This probability that something detected in some element here is going to be, some emitted from this element here is going to be detected on a particular line. So the very simplest P that you can imagine would just be a bunch of ones and zeros. In this case, the P for this J and this I would be one, but say for this J and this I would be zero. There's no probability that this radiation here would make it in. So it's just a geometric bunch of ones and zeros, which is a very sparse matrix. Then you could do a little bit more sophisticated ray tracing, which is what everyone does, and acknowledge that this ray might go through some pixels more completely than other pixels, so they would have a larger p-value than the ones that just barely goes through the edge of them. And that's sort of the next level of complexity. You could do something like put attenuation in there. You could say this radioactivity from here is less likely to make it through here than radioactivity from here is to make it through on this line, because it has more tissue to go through. You could model resolution effects. If this is a gamma camera down here and not a PET ring, and you're talking about how many counts are going to get here, there's some probability that radiation from even over here will make it in, not just along this ideal trajectory, but the whole cone of acceptance of the collimator. So that whole area there would be non-zero probabilities. And then another thing you could do is actually put the background into these probabilities. You could say, well, with scatter, there's some probability that radiation from here could actually make it into this element over here. And then just about anything from anywhere could have a non-zero probability of detection. If you put attenuation into there, with PET, you can correct the raw data for attenuation before you start, or you can put it into the reconstruction process. And these two images right here show the difference. This is just pre-correcting the data and then feeding the corrected data into the reconstruction. This is telling the reconstruction to do the attenuation, putting the attenuation probabilities into P. And in some cases, it's pretty great. The biggest differences are when the data are when the attenuation is very non-isotropic. Say if there's a lot more attenuation in this direction than this direction, it means the counts are, if you do a correction, the counts become less and less Poisson-like. Okay, and this is sort of an explanation this is imaging this part of the body here. There's a huge amount of attenuation this direction. There's not nearly so much this direction. The PET sinogram, raw sinogram, looks like this. And if you just correct the raw sinogram for attenuation, it boosts up the counts correctly, but you can see how noisy these counts are. And so they're noisy to start off with, and you're just boosting them up. And then if you reconstruct that, you get that same kind of property that you saw before. So here's one trend, is that iterative reconstruction algorithms will be further developed and exploited for noise properties, physics modeling, and accommodation of new detector geometries. Now, with SPECT, just about all SPECT is done with parallel multi-hole collimators. And they have properties very well known. Sensitivity that's independent of distance, that just has to do with the collimator hole length and diameter. And then resolution that also depends on those diameter and length, but also gets worse as you get away from the collimator. So you absolutely always want to be up as close to the collimator as possible with any gamma camera imaging. The overall extrinsic resolution has to do with the amount of blur from the collimator, which is distance dependent, and a little bit due to the intrinsic resolution of the crystal. But those intrinsic resolutions are 3.5, 4, 4.5 millimeters, and the collimator blurring is 10, 15 millimeters for, say, a typical SPECT study. So the extrinsic resolution really has mostly to do with the collimator resolution and very little to do with the intrinsic resolution. Pinhole collimation has the capability to take you away from that limitation. With, say, two objects here, you want to see how far apart they are. Going through a pinhole, they get magnified, and now the intrinsic resolution of the detector back here hardly makes any difference anymore because you've magnified the image so much. If you look at the properties, spatial resolution as a function of distance from collimator for just one particular comparison of pinhole collimator, and you can see that the spatial resolution decreases with all of these as a function of distance. But the sensitivity, which is just flat for a parallel hole collimator, gets much, much better as you get closer to a pinhole collimator. So the question is, what are the situations where you can exploit this, where you can have the object very close to the pinhole in the pinhole collimator? Another aspect of this is that if you, so at some point you need to magnify the object enough so that you're overcoming the intrinsic resolution of the detector. So if that detector is 4 millimeters and you want to get 2 millimeters, you sort of need to multiply the magnify by 2 times. Well, if you start off with a detector that's higher intrinsic resolution, then you can put it closer. You don't need as much detector area. So this is a benefit of solid state detectors using pinhole magnification. Say you don't need this big thing back. So if you're trying to put these around the body, you can imagine that you could put more of them in there if you're using these than if you're using these, and have even higher sensitivity. So this is a very commonly used application of pinhole SPECT these days, which is mouse and rat imaging. This is on a three-head human system with these big pinhole collimators put on there. This is where the mouse is right there, and these are just the three heads of the gamma camera. And you can do really good stuff. These are rods here in this JZAC-like Phantom, 0.75 millimeter rods in this case, which are resolved. This is the work of Bennett Chin, who I quoted. He's the one who's doing the animal studies. This system was designed by Scott Metzler, and Ron JZAC has been working with him. And for those of you who do veterinary medical physics, I'm sure you'll appreciate the benefits. If you can do a gated mouse heart study, blood pool study, the effect that could have on mouse health in the world. But as in many cases, obviously there are benefits to what you can do with preclinical research in small animals. But it's also interesting just to see how far you can push this technology to the resolution that you need for mice. And so this is the blood pool, this is the left ventricle, and to do this dynamically gated, it's just I find it impressive. Now, what else is going on that's dramatically different in the world of SPECT? This is the D-SPECT cardiac scanner. What is it? If it looks almost like something you'd expect to find here in Houston, sort of like rocket-related. This guy's getting ready to shoot off into space. These slides were provided by Jim Patton of Vanderbilt, who's working with the spectrum dynamics and evaluating this system. Inside this, it looks very little like a typical gamma camera. You have a bunch of these very small gamma cameras, and these gamma cameras are built from solid-state cadmium zinc telluride detectors with small parallel hole collimators. They are not pinhole collimators in this case. And one of the things about these solid-state detectors is that they don't have any edge effects. With a sodium iodide crystal and photomultipliers, there's some outer edge, about the outer half photomultiplier diameter, that you cannot image. And these allow you to image right out to the edge. So that's a benefit for a lot of applications. And so you put all these together, and looking from the side, this is, the body is going in and out here of this screen. These are just a bunch of little cameras that can rotate back and forth. And they each individually scan, and you're seeing the body from a bunch of perspectives, but the whole thing does not move. These just orbit back and forth. And see, each one of them scans back and forth, sort of focused on the object of interest, which is the heart. There's a device which is different. It involves a geometry that's a little bit more like pinhole. You have detectors around. This is the cardiac arc. And this information came from cardiarc.com. All these, and they talk about both CZT and photomultiplier sodium iodide detectors. Slits going around this way that collimate the photons, and these slits actually move back and forth. And then these, if you're in from the PET world, these things that look sort of like septa that define each slice. So it's a little bit pinhole-like in one dimension, but in the other dimension, it's just devices that keep the slices separated. And so this is another way. Because you are imaging a well-known target, the heart, which is relatively close to these detectors, you can sort of benefit from this geometry. Here's something a little bit different, and this is a very old, this idea goes back to the early 90s. One concept was use cone beams, a collimator that focuses on the object. Well, with cone beam and fan beam, you miss some of the object. You have some truncation, so you could combine cone beam and parallel beam on two different heads. And that was something some people worked on. This was one collimator that sort of tried to do everything, focusing in the middle area, but still have some holes that capture the whole object. And this is a IQ SPECT from Siemens. So a trend there, animal SPECT will continue to push the limits of pinhole collimation. Solid-state detectors will be used where they're geometrically beneficial, and dual nuclide studies may drive additional applications for solid state. The high energy resolution would be a big benefit if you're trying to image two radionuclides with emissions that are nearby. Or even if they're not nearby, you still get a lot of downscattered. So that's a big benefit there. Now, in the world of hybrid imaging, there are still many more gamma cameras than there are PETs. But there are more PET CTs than SPECT CTs. In other words, PET CT has caught on completely. SPECT CT has not. Why? Well, one of the benefits of having this CT on there is attenuation correction. Attenuation correction has for a long time been considered essential for PET. The X-ray provides an attenuation map faster than you could do with conventional PET systems, so it's a win. Attenuation correction is still mostly considered a luxury for SPECT, and it adds to the time of the scan compared to what you were doing. In the PET case, it speeds things up. In the SPECT case, it slows things down, all based on what was done before. Cost, about 10 years ago, a PET, state-of-the-art PET, you expected to pay about $2 million. Now, a state-of-the-art PET CT, you expect to pay about $2 million. So the price hasn't really even gone up. That's very different for gamma cameras, where, you know, I don't know, $300,000 or so for a gamma camera, and SPECT CT, even with the very lowest end CT on there, is going to cost substantially more. And in most cases, it's more like adding a gamma camera to a CT in terms of cost. Clinical applications. Almost all patients receiving oncologic PET have a CT anyway. CT is useful information for interpreting the PET. It's useful on its own for oncology. Gamma cameras are used for many diverse applications, some of which have CT benefit, not all. So here's this the GE Hawkeye, which has been out for about 10 years now. It's the one with the very low end CT that just rotates with the gantry. Here's the Symbia Siemens, which looks all under one hood, but it's separate gantries rotating, SPECT and CT. And this Philips, which is definitely at the other end, the precedence, this full-blown CT with a gamma camera hanging out in front of it. This is the stalactite version of gamma camera, where most are stalagmites coming up from the floor. This really new thing from Philips, I suspect that the other thing did not sell very well. This is a, I think, much more moderately priced CT. It's a flat panel, sort of like what Varian offers with their Linacs, that rotates. It's a slow rotation, but this flat panel actually images a fair amount of the body. So with a few rotations, and fairly quickly, you can get CT of the entire body with this system. This is taking the high-end CT to the limit with this the GE system. This is a rotating gamma camera just completely out in front of the 64-slice CT. It all has to do with application. And if the application is cardiac SPECT plus cardiac CT, you need to have the very highest-end CT that you can have. It's no point in having a lower-end CT to do cardiac measurements like this. I'm spacing out on what you call this kind of stuff. Okay. But to be able to measure the perfusion and to see any issues in the any restrictions in these arteries, I mean, the faster the CT is and the larger the volume it can measure simultaneously, the better off you are. Now, here's a completely different application. Here's this also dedicated to a particular organ. This is hybrid SPECT CT mammotomography, done by my colleague Martin Tornai and his group at Duke. This is parallel hole SPECT with solid state detectors, and the idea with this SPECT device is you can actually do better than a dedicated device because you can get in close to the breast. Pendulous breast, this device can get at just about any angle and it can orbit around, and so it can get good images just because of its proximity. And there's also this CT on here that orbits around. And here's the recent result they have in three dimensions, three planes, CT, and then the superimposed SPECT. So they're getting some nice results now. So here's a trend. SPECT systems will continue to be available with a range of CT, but the applications will really drive the technology to what's really available. Now, on the PET side of things, one of the questions that you could always ask in the past is once oncology, whole body oncology became the main focus of PET. You say, well, can't you just make the PET system better by making it longer? If it's got a 15 centimeter field of view now, why not just double that, make it 30 centimeter field of view, and then we'll be able to, as we go through the body, we'll be able to spend twice as long on each section, get twice as many counts, and we'll have better imaging. And if, you know, back when the target imaging was the heart and the brain, extra field of view didn't buy you anything, but now it does. So to me, that would be a question that manufacturers could always ask is, well, do we want this new scintillator or this new time of flight or whatever, or do we want to just invest that same amount of money into more detector material? So what does it do? If you're doing 2D imaging, doubling the field of view or extending the field of view just proportionately gives you more sensitivity for the rest of the body. In 3D, however, it gives you that extra coverage of the body, but it also gives you more sensitivity for those edges. So you just think about it, you're getting more angles as well as more planes. And so the sensitivity sort of goes up as the square of the axial field of view. And this is what Siemens has done with their TrueV product. They've increased the axial field of view by about 33%. And one question you could ask is if you have a scintillator that's maybe 2 centimeters of LSO like they have, it doesn't stop all the radiation. Are you better off putting it in back and making a more sensitive detector that way? Or are you better putting it off side by side? And in this simple case, say 1 centimeter, 1 centimeter, or 1 centimeter, 1 centimeter, you can say, yes, it's better to do this. You stop more in the first centimeter than you do in the second centimeter. But this other centimeter out here needs another photomultiplier, and this one doesn't. So it's an interesting optimization question, but it's ultimately the manufacturer that's figuring out how to do that. Another issue with PET, when you detect something between these two scintillator crystals here, you know that it came from somewhere in this column. When you detect something between these two scintillator modules, scintillator detectors, you know it came from somewhere in this column. This column is wide. It's not as big as this one. So this is just one way of expressing that the spatial resolution in the PET system gets worse as you get out to the edge. You just don't have as much information. PET systems on the whole don't have this really gross effect like collimator blurring that you have on a SPECT system, but there are still some resolution effects that you'd like to fix. So you can put this blurring into the reconstruction. If you're using iterative reconstruction, you can model this effect in your iterative process. And that's this sort of thing is beginning to happen. You see this commercially. So just here's a phantom. We're talking about a different topic now. Iterative reconstruction still, generally going from very blurry to less blurry, but noisy as we go through these iterations. And one kind of plot you'll see to analyze this image quality looks like this. Something related to, say, the signal in the image or the resolution, how sharp, how strong do small lesions look versus the noise. So being high on this axis would be bad. Being high on this axis would be good. Generally, good is this direction. As you iterate through, you increase resolution, but you also increase noise. So one of the things that's been found with iterative reconstructions is that if you put the corrections into the loops, you might not necessarily get better images, but you get the same image faster with few iterations. That's one thing. In this case, this is two different ways of doing random event correction, PET. Good way, bad way. This is some work. There are things that you're trying to image in the body, like the heart and anything near the diaphragm, that are moving while you're doing a PET scan. This is some work from Dr. Molloy at MDA, gating both the PET and the CT. And as you get whatever you do to improve image quality in PET with resolution, you're going to be limited by the motion if you're near moving parts of the body. It's not so this is gating the PET. And it's different. In PET, you're just dividing the counts up into different bins. With CT, you're actually acquiring short total images of each phase and taking those and trying to sync them up so that you can do the attenuation correction of the PET on the appropriate CT and also so you'll have full-blown 4D images. Of course, this has great application for radiation therapy where you want to take these, both PET CT and apply them, and put them into 4D treatment. The extent to which it will have an effect on diagnostic imaging is still to be determined. It's just how bad is the respiratory effect for any given person. It's bad for some people. It's not so bad for other people. Bad for some lesions, not so bad for other people. Now, time of flight is a very interesting thing that is being investigated. It's a product with Philips. Just this notion that if photons are generated sort of on one side of the center, this one goes a distance D1, this one goes a distance D2, that this pulse will come earlier than this pulse, and the difference in those two times will just be 2x, where x is the displacement from the center of the annihilation point, 2x over the speed of light. And so you can calculate x by looking at that time difference. So if you have that information, if you actually have really good timing resolution, and you can tell about where each event came from, and the key there is about where each one came from, without any kind of timing information, each measurement could come from anywhere along that line. And say, thinking about filtered back projection, it would project back counts through that whole line. If you just know where the body is, then you know that counts are only coming from that area, contributing to each line of response. So the things aren't quite as bad as the actual full matrix of the image. But with some timing resolution, you might be able to actually put each event to a smaller segment that corresponds to the timing resolution, this small d. and you expect your improvement to go as the size of the body over the size of this timing resolution. So it actually helps large bodies better. The large bodies are the ones that produce the poor images because of scatter and attenuation and all kinds of other reasons. So it's all a question of how good is this resolution. And this is one of the things that's driving new PET detector development, is now this high timing resolution is now a factor that's being put in. And here's some work that went on at University of Pennsylvania. This is from this publication shown here. They show that in a large 35-centimeter phantom, image quality really does improve. The nice thing about time of flight is you can just turn the information off. You can ignore it. So it's really easy to do evaluations of how much it's improving things clinically or in phantoms, more so than, say, some other new modalities. And here's a case where some lesions are much more conspicuous with the time of flight information put on there. This is a system that really drives the PET complexity to its limit. It's the HRRT high resolution brain tomograph, and it's two layers of crystals surrounding the brain. It's a small ring because it's just for PET, very high sensitivity and very high spatial resolution. And you can see, if any of you have done this Hoffman brain phantom, in this system you actually see the separate layers of the system, which is really impressive. It was designed so that you would never see those layers because of the limited spatial resolution. And you see some really impressive images. This system is very complex. It's not atypical for someone to have to work for about a year on this thing just to get it up and running, to do all the calibrations. And it was a limited number of these that were produced. Actually, you can do pretty well these days on a standard PET system that has maybe 5 millimeter intrinsic resolution, but has plenty of sensitivity to give you counts to support that, so you really don't have to smooth, and so you realize that resolution. So here is a new product that actually took a little bit of a redesign. This is a big bore system that 85 centimeter aperture. Typical PET now has a 70 centimeter aperture. This is even bigger. And you know, how many of these will sell? It's like, you know, I'm fairly tall. I need a car with big headroom, but you know, a company can sell a car that will be good for 90% of people and not have enough headroom for me, and maybe they don't care. You could argue the same, you know, how many patients need a bigger bore? Is it enough to justify the lower sensitivity that you would have, the extra cost? We'll see. The market drives these sort of things. PET-MR, I don't have a lot of time to say much about that. The issues are making PET detectors work in a magnetic field, making PET detectors that don't perturb the field too much as well, so the MR still works, and coming up with enough applications to drive the product. And you know, is that the case? Small animal, in this case, you have a PET insert inside the magnet. Human brain imaging, you have a PET insert inside the human whole body magnet. Human body, here's one concept. This is not FDA approved that I got from Philips. It's just to have completely separate devices in one table. They have them far enough apart that they don't affect each other too much. This other concept is the more prevalent one, and this is the one that Siemens has taken with their neuro insert, PET insert, to go inside the MR magnet. So, just briefly, here's another case. The breast, because it's sort of exterior to the body in most of its dimensions, can be imaged on its own. Most organs can be done this way. And PIM, positron emission mammography, benefits from that. Detectors surrounding the breast have a lot less attenuation than if you were imaging whole body, and you can get a lot better geometric sensitivity. Different geometries that people have proposed. This is just a system that we have and that we've investigated. PET detector here, compression paddle. And because of this really high sensitivity and low attenuation, you can see very small lesions, 4 millimeters, 3 millimeters. And this is a case where you could not do this without iterative reconstruction because it doesn't have full 360-degree detection. But you put it into this algorithm, and it knows that what you have, and it does a pretty good job. And the coronal resolution is not as good as the transaxial because of that issue, but it's still pretty good. And these are just some images that we've gotten. Now, one of the things... why do you even need to do attenuation correction, or why do you need to do a transmission scan? It's because You know, you can't just assume that the body is uniform. So one of the really new techniques that might come about, if you saw the movie The Abyss, they used this technique where people could go down to really great depths under the ocean because they got this oxygenated fluid in their lungs. They got that in there and took a little while to adjust, but then they could go, then pressure was no longer an issue. Well, you know, if you can put some high density liquid or just water density liquid into people's lungs so that they no longer have air in there, then you could imagine you wouldn't need to do a transmission scan anymore. You could just assume uniform density in the object. And that'd be much simpler than just doing a transmission scan, right? Not really. Okay, so here's some concluding comments. SPECT and PET are based on mature technologies, but new concepts are being incorporated. Iterative image reconstruction is essential. Quantitation must be a standard. It was in the past. It's gone away a little bit, but we measure radioactivity in nuclear medicine, and that's got to continue to be something that's demanded of instrumentation. General purpose systems have been the norm. The specialized devices will proliferate if applications demand. For example, cardiac SPECT systems that are there because so much cardiac SPECT is done. And new image-based standards for system performance will be essential. These new cardiac geometries are so different that you can't really talk about sensitivity or resolution in terms of a conventional gamma camera and how that will translate to image quality. Time of flight PET is the same thing. We've just talked about counts and sensitivity and spatial resolution in the past. We really have to have more image-based standards for acceptance and for image system performance in the future. Thank you very much for your attention.